I brought a handout, and what that means when I bring the handout for the chapter, it means that it's our last week in the chapter. Okay, so we're going to finish Daniel 3 today. That would be verses 13 through 30. But we've done a lot of background already, a lot of, even talked about some of the things that are going to come. So I think we'll be able to do it. There are a few critical points and applications that we'll want to be sure to make. We'll be able to do that along the way. I'd like, I'll read it. I like to read, and you're not always so quick to volunteer, so I take that to mean you like me to read too. And this will give me a chance, if I want, to insert a little commentary along the way in verses 1 through 12, I think then from 13 and on, then we'll return, and that'll be the subject of our study this morning. But King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold 90 feet high, 9 feet wide. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. He then summoned the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials to come to the dedication of the image he had set up. So the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials assembled for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and they stood before it. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, "This is what you are commanded to do, O peoples, nations, and men of every language." And remember, we're in Babylon, we're in Babel, and men of every language are being called here to worship a false god. And he says this, "As soon as you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and all kinds of music, you must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace." Therefore, as soon as they heard the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, and all kinds of music, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language fell down and worshipped the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. At this time, some astrologers came forward and denounced the Jews. They said to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You have issued a decree, O king, that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and all kinds of music must fall down and worship the image of gold, and that whoever does not fall down and worship will be thrown into a blazing furnace. But there are some Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon," that is to say, over us. They are our bosses, and we don't like the fact that these foreigners are in charge of us, and you set them over us, and now they're not obeying you. They're not paying attention to you, O king. They neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold you have set up." Furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summoned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king, and Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold I have set up? Now when you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipes, and all kinds of music, if you are ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. But if you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then what god will be able to rescue you from my hand?" Very important question there. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And here's really the center of the chapter. I'll give you an outline in a minute which shows you how this is really the center piece. They replied to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the god we serve is able to save us from it, and he will rescue us from your hand, O king. But even if he does not, we want you to know, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar really got mad with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and his attitude toward them changed. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times hotter than usual and commanded some of the strongest soldiers in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and throw them into the blazing furnace. So these men, wearing their robes, trousers, turbans, and other clothes, were bound and thrown into the blazing furnace. The king's command was so urgent and the furnace so hot that the flames of the fire killed the soldiers who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. and these three men, firmly tied, fell into the blazing furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar leaped to his feet in amazement, and he asked his advisors, "Weren't there three men that we tied up and threw into the fire?" They replied, "Certainly, O king." He said, "Look, I see four men walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed, and the fourth looks like a son of the gods." Nebuchadnezzar then approached the opening of the blazing furnace and shouted, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out. Come here." So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire, and the satraps, prefects, governors, and royal advisors crowded around them. They saw... This is unbelievable here. I mean, it's believable, but it's astonishing. They saw that the fire had not harmed their bodies, nor was a hair of their head singed. Their robes were not scorched, and there was no smell of fire on them. Then Nebuchadnezzar said, very important statement here, "Praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own god." He didn't say the only god. That would have been better. But "Therefore, I decree that the people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be cut into pieces and their houses be turned into piles of rubble, for no other god can save in this way." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. So now they're even bigger bosses than they were before. But a lot of fun stuff in there. This really is an entertaining story. It doesn't diminish its historical accuracy. But the author had some fun with it, right? I mean, he there's a bit of some satire, irony going on here, and humor, and it's quite enjoyable to read. Well, we can't look at every part of it, but we are going to look at some main points, beginning, as I said, in verse 13, and maybe we'll take it by sections, and we can even follow the outline on the handout that you're now receiving. I put two outlines. Both of them follow the same verse divisions. One of them just is more a longer descriptive one, and then one of them reflects the parallels here, the chiastic structure with that center, as I mentioned to you in verses 16 to 18. So either one you're looking at, let's look now at verses 13 to 15, in which Daniel's friends are given a second chance, right? Did you catch that? I mean, the king could have just said, "Oh, you didn't bow down? Into the fire you go." But he doesn't, right? He's kind of reasoning with him, like, "No, you got to, maybe you want to reconsider your decision, because this is what's really going to happen, and, I know you guys are good official." I'm speculating a little bit, but based on what we've learned already in chapter 1 and 2, right at the end of 2, were they mentioned? Yes. He could have a positive feeling towards them and not want to destroy them. So he's giving them a chance to change their minds and to bow down and worship. Any thoughts or observations you have on verses 13 to 15? This is not a section that I think requires a lot of our time.
At least my translation says, "Is it true?" in 14. So I think even though in 13 it says he's in rage and anger to bring him to him, like you said, I think there's a hesitancy just to say off with their heads immediately.
Right.
I think also there's a political savvy that they could be being set up by mm-hmm. folks.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so there's a period of finding out for himself, mm-hmm. not just taking someone else's word.
And so in that regard, he would be a little bit sharper than Darius in chapter 6, who doesn't realize he was set up. Good.
Can they also, if do not be surprised when you find yourself in fiery trials.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, we act like, oh, why are we having all... You know, it started way back, and we need to expect that if you take a stand, we're going to be attacked, and not to act so surprised, but then to do like they did. Doesn't say anything about their response, but I'm imagining, as a human, I would be shaking a little bit. Maybe they didn't, but I think that, you know, just having to face it was anxiety magnified. And they didn't say anything about them, you know, getting upset, worrying, running, anything. Good lesson.
Yes. And the verse that Becky referenced there, I didn't make the handout. I had to cut, but it's in 1 Peter 4:12, where it says, do not be surprised at the fiery trials. Good. And then I already mentioned, I think, the importance of the question here at the end of verse 15, what God, right, this is the test, the question, what God can save you from this fiery furnace? The Nebuchadnezzar is exalting himself and the Babylonian gods as supreme, so nothing can possibly beat us. Certainly not Judah's God. I mean, Judah was conquered. We walked over Judah. We carried off their leaders, and but we're gonna see Nebuchadnezzar is gonna answer that question himself in verses 28 and 9.
I think it's interesting how strong their convictions are that they say, even if we die, we would rather die having faith in our God and being true to that call in that life. And it just it reflects so many other people of the Bible. Esther, if I perish, I perish. And Paul, you know, if I live or if I die, you know, it's all gain. And I think that kind of faith and even the martyrdom, the willingness, we hear stories of the martyrs, you know, down through the ages where someone has seen a death, Stephen's death. And the death has brought on so many more people to see that they died for something of value, not living worthlessly.
Yes, that's good. So we're in 16 through 18 now, and I want to take that a step further. I want to ask you a question. Many Old Testament scholars say that in the Old Testament there is not the hope of a resurrection, except they'll say in Daniel 12:2. Is the first mention of a belief in a, you know, an afterlife. And if you're thinking that, well, this is a crazy view that's only held by unbelievers, this is actually, I've heard it out of the mouths of students at a school in Dallas. So what's the connection here is there's not, we would agree. They do not say, you can throw us into the fire, it doesn't matter because we will live again. They don't say that. It's not explicit. But here's the question. Is it implicit? Does the hope of resurrection account for their actions? Or can you say it really doesn't have any bearing? Let me say it another way, in case that's not clear. If these guys did not have the hope of something after, would it make any sense for them to say, throw us into the fire? I would, and maybe my thinking on this is wrong, but in my thinking, if there's nothing else, then why am I going to stand up and fight for this God? Right? I mean, if there's nothing else and all I've got is right now, then I need to prolong the right now as long as I can, whatever that takes. And if this, so to me, that is an argument for an implicit belief in the resurrection. Yep.
Well, and then in the New Testament, of course, all the apostles who were willing to do half horrendous deaths.
Right, but they're saying that the belief in the hope of a resurrection develops, evolves, and so, yeah, by the time of the New Testament, then they all agree. I mean, if they're Christians, They have to, but they're saying that they didn't have one early on, and I would say hogwash, in the most strongest terms, going, and I think I can find an implicit belief of the resurrection in Abraham, if not before. Yes?
In 17, where he says, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire. He doesn't stop there, and he goes on to say, and he will deliver us out of your hand. And so to me, even what you're saying, if there wasn't that hint of the resurrection, why not just stop and say he'll deliver us from the fire? But even if he doesn't, he's going to deliver us. So that, to me, that might even imply what your suggestion, that either way they're going to be delivered.
Okay.
Definitely implies they have no fear, and that's the opposite of a hope. And if you're going to respond in hope or you're going to respond in fear,
right.
They did not respond in fear.
Right.
So what would they have to look forward to?
Well, these are sharp guys, and they, I mean, by virtue of what's gone before and talking about them, and they sense that God's doing something very special here, I think. In other words, I mean, it's a radical position that they take. It's not a logical position. And so there's a sense that they had thought this through, like the five guys killed in Ecuador had thought through. I mean, they had weapons. They had thought through, what if we're attacked? We'll allow ourselves to be killed, because if we shot them, then that would end the gospel coming to this group. So they had already made the decision about what ifs, kind of thing. And so I think that we could argue that the guys had thought through. They understood what was, when they chose not to do that, they understood they're going to stand out. Eventually somebody's going to rat them out. They had already thought through what the consequences were. Probably had discussed it. I would also assume that the Spirit of God had given them insight into. So this is all a major setup kind of thing. God's at work here. We're not told how, but it's illogical, some of the things, and so that's why I think it must be that we're prompted by the Spirit of God. They were given the words. They understood the power encounter that was taking place.
I don't know if you're saying this or not. I don't know that you are, but I would... I think verse 18 would make it clear that they don't know what's going to happen. They don't know that there's going to be a fourth guy walking around. They don't know that the king's going to say, hey, come out, you know, like, why are you staying in there so long? And they say, if he does not, and I had a few quotes, one at least, which I had to cut, but which I like, this is on the last page, verse 17, the Hebrews were not prepared to tell God what their fate should be. If he should grant their deliverance, all was well. If not, God's wisdom was still best. And there you can think of Job 13:15, in which he says, though he slay me, yet I will hope in him. Their part was to obey God and leave the consequences to him. And this is very important, right? Because God sometimes chooses to deliver. And he does it here in a mind-blowing way. Not even the smell of smoke on their clothes. But sometimes...
We always want deliverance.
And we think if
God doesn't deliver us, where is he?
Mm-hmm. Right. Sometimes he chooses to deliver, and here he does. And sometimes he doesn't. And I was reading in Acts this week, Acts 12. I don't know that I'd seen this quite so same way before. Remember when Peter, an angel comes in, Peter's in jail, and he chains fall off, and he opens up the doors, and he walks right out, and he... You know, and he goes there, and they're praying, and wow, Peter's alive, and God delivers, right? Well, the verse before that says Herod took off James's head. So why did God choose to allow one to be executed and then miraculously deliver the other? I don't know if we know the why. We know that, and so that's true. That's our reality today. Sometimes there's deliverance, and sometimes there's not, and we shouldn't be surprised, because that's the way he's done it.
But if there's no deliverance, it's a blessing for those who go directly to God. So, you know, it's a win-win proposition.
Right, and that, as Paul said, right, to live is Christ, to die is gain.
Mm-hmm. And they're so resigned to his will that even though they've been given this demand, in 17 it says, if we are thrown. They're not certain they're even going to be thrown in, much like Abraham and Isaac, doing everything he had to do at the last minute, knowing God had to intervene somehow. They didn't care what was going to happen to them. They were just going to follow what they knew was right.
That's right.
Well, deliverance can come through death. He says, you deliver us from death, or you deliver us by death. So, and if we look at it that way, then he's always consistent that he will deliver us.
Good.
I think it's very interesting that from a political standpoint, the king set them up to successfully win this challenge against their enemies. Easy task. Win-win. Because he chose his attitude change. He likes these guys. He set them up. All you gotta do is when music goes off, bow down, all these are the guys, I'm going after them. But you gotta do this for me. And they didn't choose easy path. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Good.
And then we see another instance too of rebellion against what God is doing, like when in the wilderness for 40 years wandering. And God didn't give his time schedule. But he took care of their needs. I mean, how many people were there? About a million? Mm-hmm. I mean, there were lots of people out there. They ate. Their clothes didn't wear out. I mean, you know, they kept on as a ethnic, as a group of peoples, and just amazing. But there was rebellion in their hearts and a hardness and an expectation. And so they didn't have the deliverance that they wanted and expected. And I think that speaks to us today, as Colleen was saying, we're very immediate. And I remember, too, when the missionaries in Afghanistan, you know, were taken before the girls. And they said, well, why don't they? We saw lots of miracles in Afghanistan. And people said, well, why don't we see them today? And they said, because we're not desperate enough. We do not truly look at God and understand what he's doing and want to be a part of it. So he doesn't work in a way that may be as miraculous as it could be.
Yeah. I'm not sure if I would echo what they said, because I might, God's sovereign. Sometimes he chooses to do miracles, sometimes he doesn't. So maybe it's because of a lack of faith, maybe it's not. So I just would be a little bit careful in giving my explanation for God's actions. It could be wrong. But we're in the next section now, 19 through 23. We've been kind of going ahead, and that's fine, but I just want to make sure we move through here and point out any kind of curious things. Note that Nebuchadnezzar gets his strongest soldiers. These are the army rangers, right? These are the guys who can handle anything, and even they can't withstand the fire just from being close, just pushing them in. He loses his strongest soldiers. Nebuchadnezzar, right? See the contrast here. Nebuchadnezzar cannot protect his best soldiers outside the furnace. God protects just three average guys inside the furnace. Another thing here, verse 21 tells us. And again, we got this repetition, right? That so throughout this whole story, it doesn't just say they were wearing clothes. It says they were dressed in their robes. And you may have different translations because we're not sure what all these words mean. But robes, trousers, turbans, other clothes, and that prepares us for the fact they're going to get thrown into the fire. What's going to happen to all those clothes, right? I mean, that's just poof. That's just what do they call that?
Spontaneous combustion.
What do you put on the barbecue?
Lighter
fluid. Yes.
I got this.
It's been a while since I used that. But now the king, it says he made the fire seven times hotter. That is probably hyperbole. That's probably just heat it as hot as you possibly can. They say the ovens there would have been 900 to 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit, so it wouldn't have been possible to get it really literally and I don't know, they have thermometers, you know, so I went at 7,000 degrees, would have been possible, but the point is, at maximum heat, which should have killed them instantly, as it did the other men, the furnace, we don't have any. I was hoping we would, as I was studying through this initially, I was hoping there'd be some archaeological discovery of a furnace. You know, I could show you a picture or something. No. We don't know. We don't know quite what this furnace looked like. Just haven't been preserved. But from the text, it's clear that there was an opening in the top. Maybe it was the furnace was up against a hill or something, so men could get to it, and then they're thrown inside. But there's also some kind of opening in the side so that Nebuchadnezzar can look through. And then they can come out that way, too.
Was
yes.
the furnace set up for execution or for sacrifice?
It was probably a kiln for, well, a couple suggestions right across. One was maybe it was used for building the statue. The other is maybe it was for making bricks. Because that was the standard building material in Mesopotamia is mud bricks. All right, let's go then to the next section, which is 24 through 27. What do we want to stress here? Who is this fourth person? This is a question that I think is intriguing to many. There's a fourth person. The fourth person doesn't go in, and the fourth person doesn't come out. But while they're in there, there's somebody with them, and Nebuchadnezzar sees them, and Nebuchadnezzar says, he looks like a son of the gods. Now, the King James translation, I don't know if any others do, but the King James, 400 years ago, translated this. He looks like the son of God, or a. It was singular, a son of God, not son of the gods. That's not correct, based on the Aramaic word that's used here is clearly plural, and if there's a different way, it would be for. And two, think about Nebuchadnezzar. He's not suddenly a monotheist. Now, maybe in chapter 4. Come back next week to find out if Nebuchadnezzar truly converts and whether you'll see him in heaven or not. But not here. I don't think anybody would say that. So, from his perspective, it wouldn't make sense for him to be saying this is the second person of the Trinity. He's saying this is a son of the gods, which in that world, in his world, meant a divine being. He looks like a divine figure. And they, of course, had lots of divine beings. The question I think that we have today, the two possibilities, would be, he was an angel. And Nebuchadnezzar says later on, verse 28, God sent his angel, so he calls him. Or some people believe that he is the pre-incarnate Christ. I don't know if you feel strongly about this, and we don't have a lot of time to arm wrestle over it.
I have a comment.
Okay.
I think it's interesting that when Nebuchadnezzar says something, he doesn't say, "Why aren't they being burnt up?" The thing that he's amazed by is that there's a fourth person. Yeah.
I think it's interesting that the way they usually recognize them was with a glow. Mm-hmm. How do you recognize that in a fire? You know, that's just amazing to me. Have you brought him in the fire?
There's definitely something about Nebuchadnezzar here. It seems to all be, at some point, it becomes his perspective of things. He goes from being filled with anger and rage, and it ratchets up whenever they refuse to further obey him. And he becomes filled with wrath. You know, how much greater is that? And is he energized by Satan? Who knows? But I know one thing. It's like the passage seems to be showing us something that's happening in Nebuchadnezzar.
Right. He's really the only character in this chapter. I mean, when you think of it in literary terms, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are static, right? I mean, there's nothing going on. I mean, they speak one time, and they, you know, they don't. There's no change. There's no character development. It's just, I mean, they're there and they're important to the story. But it's Nebuchadnezzar who's making all the pronouncements, and he goes from saying, "What God can save you?" to, praise be to your God, he's the only one who could save you.
You know, and just the whole first couple of chapters, first 1, 2, and 3 of Daniel, it strikes me that Nebuchadnezzar is the person being bounced back and forth. I mean, he is sort of like the main character. Daniel's big, right, and these three guys are, but, you know, you keep seeing Nebuchadnezzar pop up going, he's sort of like the everyman asking these questions. Why are these people not burning up? Right, in some sense. You know, I want to be the, you know, the center of the universe. You know, worship me. You know, it's like, he's the one asking the questions. Why are these things happening?
Right. He is the everyman, but he's also the King of Kings. I mean, he's so if it's whatever's true for him, I mean, it should be true for all the others.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, and in a way, he's in awe because I'm sure we all know God has filled us knowing there's something bigger than ourselves inside, and Nebuchadnezzar has met his match. I mean, his spiritual people and all of that, he knew their flaws, and he was above them, even though he kind of used them for different things. But this was a totally different game, and it's like your kids, when you draw a line and they keep trying to go over it, they really want to know that they won't be allowed as much as they rebel. They need to know there's someone bigger than them, so they can feel secure, and I think Nebuchadnezzar is a match of him and God.
Todd, I think in 25, where it talks about they were loose and walking, I think they were probably jumping and leaping and praising God in there. It just looked like they were walking.
I find some humor in... You know, he has to tell him to come out, you know. It's like, because he put him in there, and then, well, okay, we're in here.
You just wonder what they thought. I mean, I just think, you know, when they were thrown in and they realized they were walking around, they're like, oh,
so
my
their,
gosh.
Their ropes or whatever burned up, right?
Yeah.
Because it makes it clear, they were bound securely.
They were really dangerous.
Okay, let me take the last couple minutes we have here and try to pull it together. And I wrote a good bit in the handout that I hope will be helpful to you. But I want to say a few of the things right now. And this is not just a story in the past. This is a story that is intended to have relevance to the readers, the first readers of Daniel. The first readers of Daniel were in exile. They were living in Babylon. Their God had been defeated, allegedly. They were facing great trials. They were facing persecutions. They were facing temptations. And they were facing idols. And Isaiah had tried to prepare them and said, look, those Babylonian idols are nothing. And here we have a case where that's demonstrated. That the true God is with them. He will protect them, as Isaiah 43 verse 2 says, when you walk through the fire, I will be with you. This is intended to be a model for the Jewish people in exile facing all of these temptations as long as they need it. Of course, today there's application for us because you know, similar realities, maybe more or less depending on what part of the world you live in today, but it's important too, within the context of the book and the context of prophetic future, that the Lord is protecting Israel. There's something, it's true, we can say, you know, I'm going through the fire and the Lord's helping me, but this is his people, Israel, in exile. And I made a little note here in your outline, or maybe a couple, or in the handout, about Israel, and Daniel is going to be talking about the future kingdoms and their horns who are going to persecute the people of God unto death. And then, like in Revelation, it picks up on that. It's going to say, anybody who doesn't worship the beast will be killed. So there is an abiding significance, relevance, to this chapter for the people of Israel. I'll say it this way. Faithful Jewish people, and I have to throw in something a little bit outside of our meat, but I believe it would have to be saved after the rapture. During the tribulation, who are going to read this story, and they're going to follow suit. And some of them will be martyred, as Revelation tells us, and some of them will pass through the fire. Let's pray. Father, thank you for this encouragement of your sovereignty and your power, these themes that just run throughout the book, that you are absolutely in control. No one is stronger than you. And we see that so clearly in this astonishing deliverance from the fire. And Lord, we take from that a conviction that's true for us today. You're the same God that if as we go through the fire, small or large, that you are able to save us. And you are able to save our children. You are able to deliver the sons of those in this class who are now on the other side of the world fighting evil men. You can deliver them from the fire. And that's our prayer. We would pray for that, just as these three young men did, knowing that you could deliver, pray that you would deliver. But knowing too that your ways are higher, that you are good, and you will do what you do to accomplish your purposes and to receive the greatest glory. So strengthen our heart with this fun, interesting, and humorous story. Strengthen our heart with the knowledge of your character, that we might live in a way that magnifies you and your Son. We pray this in His name. Amen.
Thank you, Todd. Thank y'all. That was great. Do meditate on it. Yeah, Jack.